Engineering News, the most widely read publication in biotechnology, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. Sponsored by Eppendorf AG, the leading global supplier of biotechnology systems and research tools, employing more than 1,900 people worldwide. Eppendorf products include pipettes, pipette tips, Eppendorf tubes, and centrifuges, in addition to instruments and consumables for DNA analysis. Visit www.eppendorf.com to learn more about Eppendorf's DNA analysis and qPCR solutions. This week on the GenCast Network, Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling talks to Dr. John Quackenbush from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute about qPCR and research on gene expression.
Dr. John Quackenbush is Professor of Computational Biology and Bioinformatics in the Department of Biostatistics at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. He received his Ph.D. from UCLA in 1990. Dr. Quackenbush, can you tell us about the kinds of research that you and your colleagues are carrying out in your laboratory?
Well, we're kind of outliers in a way here, in the sense that a lot of our work really involves combinations of laboratory work and computational work. But really, if I had to characterize what I do, the work that I and my group do is probably best described as genomics. And what we've been working on for a number of years is actually applying technologies that have grown out of the Human Genome Project, things like microarrays and proteomics, in order to understand human disease. And being at the Dana-Farber, our focus in looking at human disease is really to try to understand cancer, how cancers develop, how they transform, and how the cancer phenotypes that we see come into being. And as part of trying to do that, we've developed a lot of software tools and computational tools and databases that facilitate analysis of those data sets with the goal of trying to really understand mechanisms and hopefully develop better diagnostic and prognostic tools, as well as to understand mechanism better so we can start to think about better ways of doing therapeutics.
Now, I read that one of your key research interests is to look at patterns of gene expression in cancer with the goal of elucidating the networks and pathways that are fundamental in the development and progression of the disease. How, in general, has the qPCR technology been useful to you in terms of studying gene expression in cancer?
Well, I think you have to look at the role qPCR plays on a number of different levels. A lot of the work we do has been driven by looking at gene expression using microarrays. And really the goal is to try to move beyond a single gene understanding of the disease state and how the disease state develops. Really what we think of in terms of cancer and many other diseases is they're systemic diseases. They arise because systems in the cell break down. And the nice thing about global technologies like microarrays is that they allow us to take a holistic picture of a cell and really see many of the things that are happening all at once. But as we generate more and more data, what we're in a position to do then is to really focus in on key sets of genes or subsets of genes that the evidence we gather tells us is associated with a particular phenotype. And on that level, qPCR is incredibly important because it's a very cost-effective way to generate data on large numbers of patients looking at small numbers of genes to really help refine the models and refine the predictions and refine the discoveries that are driven by applications of microarray technology.
You see, now, you recently co-authored a paper, in fact, it's a very interesting paper, that noted that there has only been a single published report of the variability of gene expression in single cells, which did not provide an underlying statistical model for mRNA representation within the cell. As a result, you and your colleagues said a significant gap in our knowledge exists as researchers try to construct the kinds of predictive models that are the goals of systems biology. Would you provide some more details about this gap and explain how it hinders systems biology predictive model building?
Well, if you think about the fundamental paradigm of molecular biology, DNA in regions in DNA, the genes are transcribed to RNA and eventually translated to proteins. And we're now coming to understand the whole process is much more complex. But really, if we just focus on the proteins, which are sort of the workhorses in the cell, at some stage we have to have RNA produced in the cell, and that RNA eventually leads to the production of proteins. And a few years ago, I was actually reading a paper in which someone was attempting to model gene expression data and the variability that occurs within cells. And they were using a sort of heuristic computational model that didn't make much sense to me. And so I sat back and I said, well, you know, how would I do that? And sort of a natural way of looking at biological processes or any process, any random process, is to think of it as having a Poisson distribution. And so I thought, well, you know, let's look in the literature and see whether or not there's a description of transcription occurring with a Poisson distribution in a Poisson process. And in fact, when I looked in the literature, I couldn't find anything. And so I started to look for experimental descriptions of people looking at variability and gene expression. And as you noted, only found a single published report where someone had even looked at that. And to me, this seemed like a great opportunity to sort of seize low-hanging fruit. You could look at how gene expression changes in identical cells and how those changes are governed by stochastics. And really, if you wanted to build a systems biology model that ran from DNA to RNA to protein, one important component of any kind of predictive model would be to understand the fundamental distributions of each one of the key molecules. And so it seemed to me that the starting point to really build a workable stochastic predictive model would be to start with that first element, the transcription of the gene sequence into messenger RNA. And so that's what we set out to look at in that paper.
Now, in that paper, you and your team proposed the solution to this predictive model problem with something you call mesoscopic biology. What do you mean by mesoscopic biology, and how does this approach help overcome the barriers to studying gene expression?
Well, it's very difficult to look at stochastic processes in single cells. It's very difficult to do any kind of assay in a single cell. But most of the assays we do look at large chunks of tissue, right? We look at a piece of liver or a piece of the heart or a macroscopic piece of tissue. So in physics, and my background is in physics, not in biology, people talk about mesoscopic physics in the middle between the macroscopic large-scale analysis and the microscopic small-scale analysis. And so we saw an analogy to do something very similar here in looking at gene expression in biological systems. Most of what we measure is on the large scale. What we really want to understand is on the microscopic scale. So what Jessica Marr, who was the lead author on the paper, and Renee Rubio and I postulated was that if gene expression really does have a stochastic signature, then we should be able to pick up that signature just by using simple sampling statistics, right? And we can look at the distribution of heights in a population. And what that distribution tells us is that when we look across thousands of people, we're going to see a very well-described mean and standard deviation for the measurements that we make. But if you look at small subsets of that population, you may see deviations from the population average and the population standard deviation. And you should be able to predict what the form of that deviation is. So if I were to go and randomly sample buses and look at average height on buses, you know, there are chances for me to grab a bus like an NBA player's bus where the distribution is going to be skewed. And it just turns out that in doing sampling, when you sample small populations, the chances that you're going to see something which is far from the average for the whole population is greater. So in looking at mesoscopic biology, what we started to think about was, well, if we didn't look at millions of cells, but maybe thousands or hundreds of cells, where we could do quantitative RT-PCR assays, if we actually measured the variability as a function of the number of cells, we should be able to test whether or not that variability was actually described by some predictive model. And in fact, what we showed in this paper was that if you assume Poisson statistics, you predict a form for how the variability changes as you increase or decrease the number of cells in any particular assay. And if you do repeated measurements for any given number of cells, you can actually recreate exactly that distribution.
Now, that sort of leads to my next question, which I think you probably already answered. That was, what were you able to clearly demonstrate at the end of that paper by employing the mesoscopic technique?
Well, I think what we were able to do is two things. One, we showed for the first time that in steady state, gene expression obeys simple Poisson statistics. And that's something that really wasn't a big surprise, but was something that I think someone had to show, someone had to write down, someone had to clearly demonstrate. But the other thing that I think was really interesting about this study is it actually opens up kind of a new way of thinking about looking at stochastic processes. And that is, rather than focusing on individual cells, there's room to really understand how variability in biological systems affects measurements that we can make. And this at least gives us a hint of a way at which we can start to make predictions about what that variability should look like, and then test those predictions in ways that are experimentally tractable. So we're really excited to see this paper published, and actually very excited about the results, because we think it has opportunities, or gives us opportunities, to open up new areas of investigation.
Okay, now my final question, I want to get back to qPCR, since this is part of our series on qPCR and life science research. Could you talk a bit about how qPCR was used in specific instances in your work that ultimately helped support your mesoscopic biology approach?
Well, the assays we did in this study were almost exclusively quantitative RT-PCR. We did a first analysis of the cell lines we were looking at using DNA microarrays, in order to just pick out subsets of genes that seem to be expressed at high, medium, and low levels. And part of our justification was we wanted to really see that the effects that we were predicting were occurring independent of transcript level. So after that initial screen using a microarray, really all the assays that we did were qPCR assays. So we did a few hundred qPCR assays looking at 9 different genes, a dilution series of cell lines, a dilution series of RNA as a set of controls. And really, qPCR was the key measurement technique that we used to support both the argument we were making in the paper and the conclusions that we drew. So quantitative RT-PCR was an essential element. And it's an assay that, in fact, we find has a whole host of uses in applications to biological systems. So while we've talked mostly about this mesoscopic biology approach, really, if we come back to most of what my group does, we're looking at gene expression in disease. We're trying to develop diagnostic and prognostic tools. And while microarrays are a great way to find signatures that we can use, my bet is that qPCR is ultimately going to be a key player in moving from the exploratory phase to the implementation phase for any of these gene expression signatures, because it's quick, it's reliable, and it's relatively low cost. And then in terms of validation experiments that we do, qPCR is absolutely essential. We make measurements on microarrays, but you know, at the end of the day, if we really want to tie something down and really want to know what we're measuring, we turn back to what's become the gold standard in molecular biology, qPCR.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Now we would like your input on some of the topics discussed during this week's podcast. Please go to www.genengnews.com/blog and answer the following question. What do you see as the major barriers to obtaining a better understanding of gene expression systems, and what might be some ways to overcome these obstacles? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Next week's guest, Dr. Carrie Mullis, the Nobel Prize-winning inventor of PCR. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.